Where have we heard this before? Arizona has to close a budget deficit. Will lawmakers need a hatchet or a chainsaw?
If we were to cut 10% from all levels of state government, except K-12 and except Child Protective Services, we only save about $150 million, and we have $1 billion shortfall.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the state is poised to relive the debate over Medicaid expansion. The forecast is calling for an influx of meteorologists in the valley.
Cacti is traveling companions.
And hope you're hungry.
You could probably eat for 2 weeks and eat at a different place at this corner we picked out.
Plus, what you should be listening to in 2015, and we remember a Valley music icon.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon and Happy New Year with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's the show on KJZZ. As you might expect, nothing to report in traffic at this hour, but weather remains pretty interesting around the valley. It'll be sunny for today. We expect to reach a high of 52. Then for tonight, a hard freeze warning in effect for a lot of the valley till tomorrow morning at 9. Currently, we have clear skies and 50 degrees.
2014 was the warmest year on record in Phoenix. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the average temperature was 77.1 degrees.
Last year's average broke the previous record of 76.9 degrees, which was set in 1989. The state average has not been calculated yet, but the National Weather Service reports that number will likely be record-breaking, too. Mark O'Malley is a meteorologist with the agency. He says warmer conditions in Arizona will impact snowpack and reservoir levels, worsening the effects of a nearly 10-year drought.
Conceptually, if you have warmer temperatures, you're going to melt the snow quicker. You're not going to hold it around as long. And with the warmer temperatures during the summer, you're going to decrease the amount of moisture in the soil.
O'Malley adds the first half of 2014 set the stage for the increase. January through June were all several degrees above normal. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Hundreds of people gathered earlier today for a funeral service honoring a Flagstaff police officer fatally shot by a domestic violence suspect. Friends and family of Tyler Jacob Stewart recalled his sense of humor and fun-loving nature. The 24-year-old officer was shot Saturday afternoon while speaking with a suspect in a domestic violence situation. According to police, Stewart asked 28-year-old Robert Smith if he could check him for weapons. That's when Smith pulled a handgun and shot Stewart several times. Smith then walked away and fatally shot himself.
When state lawmakers come back into session a week from Monday, many will probably do so with a sense of deja vu. Arizona is again facing a budget deficit around $1.5 billion between the rest of this fiscal year and the new one that starts in July. Today, we'll get a sense of how the legislature and governor may try to close that gap, starting with Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times.
In some ways, this problem, this $1.5 billion, while it's not as large as the $2-plus billion that the state faced back in 2009-2010, in some ways, this problem is almost worse, though, because there really aren't a whole lot of options left for the state. When we went through the Great Recession, policymakers were able to rely on a lot of different avenues, different kind of workarounds to try to make the budget, to try to solve the budget gap. And they can't go back to the well on those things now. I mean, they can't sell state buildings anymore. They've already borrowed against the state buildings. They can't borrow against state lottery revenue. They've already done that. They can't delay funding for education. They've already done that. They did withhold money from schools. The courts have said that that was illegal, and now they're currently fighting over how much money needs to be paid back to the schools, which is another thing that could really dramatically increase the size of this deficit. It could increase it by, you know, another $1 billion, $1.5 billion.
So a $1.5 billion problem, this isn't like bake sale, finding change in the couch cushions of the House of Representatives members lounge kind of money. This is real money, even for government. Are we looking at dramatic spending reductions?
I think we're going to have to. You know, I mean, this is a budget that's, you know, a little bit more than $9 billion. When you're talking about $1.5 billion, I mean, you're
it's
talking
a good chunk.
It is, yeah. It's more than 10% of the budget that, you know, well, I guess $1.5 billion over 2 years, so over about $20 billion worth of spending, $18 billion. You know, but you're still talking a very large chunk of money, and it's becomes even more exacerbated when you look at the fact that the state can't touch most of the general fund budget. So they've got to try to find $1.5 billion out of, you know, this pot of money that may not be more than, you know, $2 or $3 billion. Obviously, I don't think they're going to be able to cut all that. I mean, if they did, there'd be wholesale agencies that would be shut down, or they'd be turning over control of things to the federal government, or passing that burden on to county and city governments, some of which will happen probably, at least that second part in terms of county and city governments. But it'll be very interesting. I think it's a time for creativity. And I think that that's really probably the message. The one thing we're going to continue hearing, I think, as the session goes forward is, you know, finding creative solutions, trying to think outside the box in terms of what the options are and how they can solve it. But it really is a pickle that they find themselves in right now.
So you mentioned that creativity is on the agenda, but a lot of the things that lawmakers and the governor could do, which I think some would say are creative, as you mentioned, selling back Capitol buildings, securitizing lottery money, those things, as you say, are kind of tapped out. You can't do them again. So what kind of creative options are being discussed at this point?
We don't know yet. Not a whole lot's being discussed. I think things are still very much in kind of the formative stage in terms of what sorts of techniques or maneuvers the state could do in order to avoid making really drastic cuts. I'm sure Governor Ducey will lay out some, certainly in his budget, and I would imagine in his State of the State speech, lay out some ways to try to save money, either through spending cuts or reforming the way certain government programs operate, and maybe through, you know, maybe he'll shed some light on exactly how he wants to maybe raise some more money without actually having to go out and raise taxes. He's certainly been a staunch opponent of tax increases. This legislature doesn't have an appetite to do tax increases either.
So if there's probably no new revenue on the horizon as far as the tax goes, where are other places that more money could be found?
That is really the $1.5 billion question.
Because if they're not going to cut their way out of a billion and a half deficit, they've got to do it somehow. So it's either you cut revenue or you get more revenue, right?
Yeah, it is. And I don't think permanent revenue, I don't think you're going to see any large chunks of permanent revenue. It might be a situation where they can kind of nibble around the edges, maybe, you know, nickel and dime together, you know, several hundred million dollars worth of revenue to supplement maybe some of the cuts that are going off, or maybe not even new revenue, but in terms of revenue savings. You know, one thing that has been talked about a lot is, and we keep hearing it more and more, is the idea of delaying some of these tax cuts that are supposed to be phased in over the next couple of years.
So what do you think are the sort of prime targets for potential cuts? I mean, where could we see spending reductions in the next year or so?
You know, I think just about every agency, I think, is probably in line to get spending reductions. I think just about everybody's probably going to be looking at taking a haircut here. And on top of that, you've got a lot of the funds that were swept during the last recession. They may not have been built up to where they were before, but I'm sure that some sweeps are going to happen there too. These dedicated funds are going to get emptied out as the state kind of scrounges around for money to try to really solve this budgetary, what is almost on the verge of a crisis right now.
Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
As you just heard from Jim Small, a huge budget deficit is nothing new for a lot of Arizona lawmakers. John Kavanaugh has been the House Appropriations Chair, but he's taking a Senate seat later this month and will serve as Vice Chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. He says history is repeating itself.
In the words of an old baseball sage, it's deja vu all over again. It's almost like we're back to 2009 when the bottom fell out of state revenue and we were confronted with a massive shortfall, billions of dollars of shortfall. We cut $3.5 billion from a budget a little over $10 billion. It could be as high as a billion next year, and it's going to be difficult because a lot of the solutions that we had before are gone. State government is a lot leaner than it was today than it was then because we haven't restored that much. Many of the funds have been drained that we relied on. We've already mortgaged some buildings and we used up the rainy day fund, although we do have a little bit of rainy day fund left. So we have a smaller problem, but potential solutions are also much smaller. So it's going to be rather difficult.
When you look at it, when you go in, is the job to come out with the job you've been commission to do, which is to pass a balanced budget, or are there ways around? Can you actually have priorities?
Balanced budget is kind of a nebulous term. I mean, every year we've done a balanced budget, although we've had to use gimmicks lately to avoid massive cuts to state government. Let me give you an example. If we were to cut 10% from all levels of state government, except K-12 because of a lawsuit, and except Child Protective Services because of all the problems they have, but everybody else, including corrections, we knock off 10%. We only save about $150 million, and we have a $1 billion shortfall. So obviously, we're going to have to do more cutting than that. I think you'll see the universities taking a fairly significant hit this time, because we do give them about $800 million. And you're going to have to see some of the gimmicks, because you just can't cut that much from state government and have any state government left.
Doug Ducey, governor-elect, was talking about changing the tax code. There are people on both sides who want to do something with the tax code. Does that seem too daunting at this point because you have practical concerns right now?
Well, I think you'll see the removal of some tax credits, particularly the ones that the conservatives don't like, the picking winners and losers credits. But there really aren't that many. And when it comes down to the rest of the credits, you really wouldn't have agreement between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans probably would like to get rid of a lot of the winners and losers and solar credits and renewable energy credits. And the Democrats want to get rid of all the tuition aid credits for charter and private schools. So we don't agree on those things. And in some cases, you may need a two-thirds vote to get rid of certain tax credits, because that could be considered a tax increase.
How about broader tax reform?
Down the road. But again, even the tax cuts that we passed for several years haven't even taken effect yet. We phased them in very slowly. That's a long journey to get rid of the personal income tax or corporate income tax completely. And then you also have to think about, you know, keeping your revenue sources balanced. You get the right mix of income tax and the right mix of sales tax. You know, this way, when you get hit with a recession, you're not totally devastated. So I still want to see some balance, although certainly the income tax is something which we should at least reduce a lot more to stay competitive with some of the more business-friendly states like Texas and New Mexico.
Is there any thought about another temporary tax? Will that even be discussed? Will that even be on the table?
It's not on the table. From the Republican standpoint, that was always off the table. And given that Fred Duval, who carried the banner for the Democrats in this last election, also said no taxes, that makes it completely out of the question to even talk about something like that, any kind of a tax increase.
John Kavanaugh, he's been the House Appropriations Chair. He'll take his new Senate seat later this month. The Arizona Supreme Court this week ruled a group of state lawmakers does have standing to sue over the funding mechanism for Arizona's Medicaid expansion. The legislators argue it's a tax, which under the state constitution requires a two-thirds vote in both chambers to pass. The plan received a simple majority.
Christina Sandifer is senior attorney at the Goldwater Institute and is representing the 36 lawmakers.
Our argument is that this tax did not get a two-thirds supermajority vote in either house of the legislature. And it should have, and therefore, the governor should not be collecting or enforcing this tax.
How is this any different than other fees that the state sets up, that agencies collect on any number of other users or other purposes without two-thirds supermajorities on those?
Well, it may not be, and that may be part of the problem. Part of the problem may be that the legislature has not been good about enforcing this provision in the past. But also, the constitutional provision here says that administrators can adjust fees as they go along, but the legislature has to authorize the tax to begin with.
So why didn't the Goldwater Institute sue over any of these other fees that were put into place by the legislature without a two-thirds vote? And why wait until this particular one?
Well, we haven't taken a close look at any other fees in the past. They really haven't been brought into our attention. But for better or worse, Governor Brewer made this Medicaid expansion and the Medicaid expansion tax really the centerpiece of her legislative agenda. And so it got a lot of attention and a lot of press. And many people came to us, these legislators included, really concerned about what this was doing to the Constitution of Arizona.
If you win your lawsuit, the practical impact, in all likelihood, given the makeup of the legislature and the makeup of the governor's office, is that a couple hundred thousand people who now have health care and have had it for a little while will lose it. And I'm curious how much of your thought process going into this lawsuit is predicated on keeping that aspect in mind, sort of that practical impact of what the result will be if you win.
Sure. Well, you know, here we are concerned with the Constitution, and when the voters put Prop 108 into place over 20 years ago, they were very clear that they wanted to curb taxes and government growth even in cases of emergency, even when concerning federal requirements, and even concerning programs for the poor. So the voters are very clear, and we really cannot pick and choose when we enforce the Constitution. That said, we are only challenging the tax portion of Medicaid expansion here, not all of Medicaid expansion. So it's true that if the tax is struck down as being unconstitutional, which we think that it will be, then the legislature is going to have to go back and find a constitutional funding source if it wants to continue along with Medicaid expansion. You know, we're headed into legislative session right now. There's nothing stopping the legislature from preemptively doing that right now if it wants to. It can repass this tax by a two-thirds supermajority vote, in which case it would comply with the Constitution, or it can find another funding source. If it doesn't do that, though, then Medicaid expansion will have to be scaled back.
Goldwater Institute attorney Christina Sandifer is representing the 36 lawmakers challenging the hospital assessment. Not surprisingly, expansion supporters see things differently. Greg Vigdor is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association.
This is not your typical tax in any way. It's something that we, as the ones who are paying it, agreed to as a concept and an approach. And really, when you look at the nature of it, it's really just this administrative arrangement where hospitals put money in so we can draw down the federal match.
Do you think there's any chance that if the court says this is not, in fact, constitutional, that the state would find another way to do it or be able to magically come up with a few more votes to do this on a two-thirds vote?
It's hard to imagine, having gone through the experience once, of where the two-thirds vote would come from. What we said from the start was that this is a policy underneath it of trying to cover Arizonans that the people of the state have voted on a couple of times. And instead of using our assessment approach, they might just have to come up with the state general fund dollars to do it, which is just going to blow an enormous hole in the Arizona state budget, which is already bleeding.
If the court finds that this is not constitutional, would you consider filing a lawsuit saying, hey, Prop 204, the voters said this population needs to be covered. You need to come up with some other way to fund it?
I think if this goes the wrong way, all options are on the table for us. It's that important an issue. Obviously, we just like to go forward and work this out. That's been our position from the start. But as this continues to be a rehash of the past political debate, I think we're starting to take a harder and harder line view about this.
What would the impact be on hospitals if this goes against you? Obviously, a lot of people would lose health insurance. A couple hundred thousand people who have gotten health coverage would lose it. But what would the impact be on your members?
Right. So our concern has always started with the people that this would affect. For us, I can just give you an example of what it's meant to us. We've had an enormous spike in hospital uncompensated care in Arizona since the Great Recession. So in 2013, that number was $600 million of unpaid hospital bills that we had to figure out what to do with, usually involved trying to pass it on to other payers. Last year, in just the first year of beginning to implement this law, that number is down to $400 million. If this goes away, somehow we're going to have that back on the table. We might even have to look at the money going backwards. And that's just an enormous amount of money.
Greg Vigdor is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association.
Coming up, we take a listen to some local music to look forward to in 2015. That's just ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Steve, I'm Mark. One traffic note, it's on an accident on I-10 eastbound at Washington. There's a hard freeze warning tonight through tomorrow morning. Look for sunny skies both tomorrow and Sunday with highs of 55 and 62 degrees. Sunny skies right now over Phoenix, 51 degrees at KJZZ at 222.
KJZZ is supported by Shenyun 2015, 5,000 Years of Civilization, live on stage. Info at shenyun.com. Coming to the Mesa Arts Center and Phoenix Orpheum February 11th through 15th.
Some U.S. banks are closing the accounts of certain customers along the Mexican side of the border. It's part of an effort to stay in line with anti-money laundering regulations. But as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, it's taking a toll on legitimate border business.
Here in the border town of Nogales, Mexico, the lunch crowd is settling in at La Roca restaurant. Its live music and traditional cuisine have made it a landmark for 43 years. The prices are listed in dollars, and many of the diners come in from Arizona. The ownership is American, and so was the restaurant's bank account and credit card until a couple months ago. Alicia Martin is one of La Roca's current owners.
I actually got a phone call by two young ladies from the bank.
Chase Bank. They said they were closing some foreign business accounts, including the account for Martin's restaurant.
And I was like, what? What are you talking about? You know, why? And she says, well, because we can't monitor you.
It was part of the bank's efforts to stay in line with federal anti-money laundering regulations.
I said, I've been with you for over 40 years and you can't monitor me? And she said, well, don't take it personally. And she says, because there have been some people that have been with us for 70 years and we're closing their accounts as well.
A Chase spokeswoman confirmed the bank is in the process of closing 5,000 small foreign business accounts. Regulators have cited the bank in the past for not having adequate anti-money laundering controls. In fact, that's one reason Chase had to pay billions in fines in recent years. Martin thought about moving her account to another U.S. bank, but heard others might soon follow Chase's lead.
What happens to those of us who do business transparently, you know, and it's honest business? I don't know. I feel like we're being punished for somebody else's deeds.
The Southwest border is seen as a higher risk area for money laundering because of drug and human smuggling organizations. Paul Hickman of the Arizona Bankers Association says banks are trying to do the right thing.
They don't want to help facilitate illegal conduct. And if they find a concentration of high-risk accounts, they're going to scrutinize those and they're going to decide, all right, what kind of resources do we have to police this?
And Hickman says if banks don't have the resources to properly monitor certain accounts,
we're certainly not going to put society at risk by continuing to potentially facilitate this type of trade.
Most of the major banks are either facing enforcement actions or there have been enforcement actions.
Dennis Lormel used to run the FBI's financial crimes program and now consults on anti-money laundering issues. HSBC came under fire a few years back for failing to stop a Mexican drug cartel from laundering millions of dollars through its banks. But as banks and regulators try to prevent that kind of crime, it's not always obvious which client accounts should be closed.
This is a very complex subject. There's no easy answer and there's no easy fix.
Bankers worry if they can't properly monitor risky customers, regulators could slap them with fines or require expensive reforms. But Lormel says regulators and law enforcement say it's counterproductive for banks to close too many accounts, since it sends transactions underground.
And unfortunately, some very honest and innocent people are getting caught up losing their banking relationships.
Cattle broker Juan Carlos Ochoa says he's another one of the honest, innocent people who lost his bank account. Ochoa is a dual citizen who imports cattle into Douglas, Arizona, and he runs this feedlot on the Mexican side of the border.
The capacity is 5,000 heads of cattle, and we are full.
Ochoa says business is good, except for the stress of where to keep his money. Back in his office, he says after Chase closed his account, he moved to Wells Fargo. Then Wells Fargo closed his account too, without offering an explanation.
I can't be without a bank account because every day I have to buy and sell cattle. Every day.
He needs a U.S. account so American buyers can easily wire him his payments. But at the same time, a number of major banks have been closing branches on the Arizona border. So there's only one bank left in Douglas that hasn't yet rejected Ochoa.
The day there are no more banks left, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Ochoa says the irony is this trend could force some border businesses to use cash. And that makes transactions less transparent and more vulnerable to money laundering. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, reporting from the Arizona border.
A couple of guys rent a U-Haul, pack it with around 1,800 potted cacti, and drive cross-country. That's not the opening line to a joke or an upcoming movie trailer, but actually a true story. Desert Botanical Garden took in the plants last year, and Raul Puente Martinez helped get them to Phoenix. He's curator of living collections. Standing in one of the garden's greenhouses, he told me about the acquisition.
We received this donation from Fred Gatterman, who has been a long-time collaborator with the garden. And he has this collection in New Jersey, and that's where he lives. So he felt that he was getting ready to pass his collection to an institution that will be taking care of, you know, and make good use of the collection. So he chose a Desert Botanical Garden for his donation.
So he's in New Jersey. You guys are obviously here. How did he get the plants from there to here?
Well, yeah, he said, I want to give the collection to the Desert Botanical Garden, but that was the cash that we had to go and get it. So in April, late March, a couple of us flew to New Jersey, and we knew that we were receiving about 1,800 cactus, 1,800 potted plants. So we had made this plan, you know, that we needed to rent a truck, a U-Haul truck, and that's what we used, and build some shelves, and then load it into the truck and drive back, you know, the whole close to 2,000 miles across the country.
So what is significant about this collection? Why is it important for it to be at Desert Botanical Garden?
It represents one of the most complete collections of South American cacti that I would say that is in any institution in North America. That's the first thing. The second thing is that most of this material was collected in the field, which for us is not only the aesthetic value from the point of view of the collection, but also the scientific value of this collection.
So from a scientific perspective, what's so much better about having cacti collected from the wild as opposed to not?
Well, there's several things, you know, what is important. One is for conservation purposes. You want to know, you know, the populations and what is the status of these populations in the wild. It will be an excellent opportunity to do genetics studies, you know, population genetics. That's just to mention one of them.
Is the plan eventually to have these out of the greenhouse and into the garden where the public can see them?
Yes, we have to wait for a few years, you know, for the plants to go through this acclimatation process for the plants. You know, the condition of growing under a greenhouse in New Jersey are very different from Phoenix. You know, even for desert cacti, you know, so it's putting them just out in the open. It's a very harsh change. So yeah, we have to go through this process. But I would say maybe 4 or 5 years for they have been here for almost 7 or 8 months now, and then we want to move it to a shade structure that would also is going to have ventilation, adequate ventilation, and eventually many of these species are from the coastal deserts, you know, in Chile and Peru, and some of them from the Andes. So yeah, we have to be very careful, you know, and finding a new location for them. You know, we want to preserve not only these specimens, you know, but all the progeny. We're already collecting seeds, so we are thinking, you know, that this collection is something that needs to be preserved. And we're already using it for research. You know, we have collected some samples for molecular studies that we're hoping, you know, that we will add more to the knowledge of the cacti.
Raul Puente Martinez is curator of living collections at Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're still way below normal as far as high temps around the valley for today. We may peak at 52. The regular high is 66 degrees. For tonight, another hard freeze warning in effect until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Then it'll warm up a bit over the weekend with highs back into the lower 60s. Currently, relative humidity is at 33%. We're sunny and 51 degrees at KJZZ. And in Valley traffic, there's one accident to tell you about. It's the 60 eastbound, that's Grand Avenue, at 99th Avenue. Otherwise, not much post-holiday traffic.
KJZZ is supported by Beach Fleischman on behalf of Tucson Jazz Festival, featuring jazz standards composer Burt Bacharach and his 11-piece band on January 28th at the Fox Theater. Tickets at TucsonJazzFestival.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. The U.S. is imposing sanctions on North Korea in retaliation for the cyber attack against Sony Pictures Entertainment, which the White House blames on that country. President Obama signed an executive order today authorizing the sanctions. The order affects three North Korean entities, including a government intelligence agency and a North Korean arms dealer. West Africa still has a long way to go to beat Ebola, according to the outgoing head of the United Nations Ebola Emergency Response Team. Tony Banbury tells NPR.
I believe we are seeing improvements in these areas. We're getting those response capabilities deployed into new areas, and we're also seeing behaviors change, but we have a ways to go in both.
Banbury says one critical need is upgrading and rebuilding public health systems across West Africa. The Ebola death toll is approaching 7,900 in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Senator Harry Reid has suffered injuries, including broken bones. NPR's Don Gagne reports he was injured while working out at home.
Senator Reid was hurt when a piece of exercising equipment he was using malfunctioned. The leader of the Senate Democrats, who turned 75 last month, fell and broke, quote, a number of ribs and bones in his face. That's from a statement released by his office. The accident took place in his home in Henderson, Nevada. Reid was taken to a local hospital, then transferred to University Medical Center in Las Vegas, where he was treated and spent the night. His office says Reid still plans to return to Washington over the weekend and will be in his office at the Capitol on Tuesday when the Senate reconvenes. A full recovery is expected. Don Gagne, NPR News.
A mixed day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones rose 9 points. The Nasdaq dropped 9. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
The Valley lost a musical icon just before the new year when Rafael Chapito Chavarria passed away. He was 100 years old. Chavarria was a bandleader who, in addition to playing clubs, was also a popular draw at weddings. His career stretched from the 1940s until his retirement in the 80s, even though he still played from time to time after that. For more on Chapito's life and legacy, we turn to Devin Leal Bridgewater. He's a musician who played in Chapito's band.
I came to know his son, Ralphie Chavarria, who was a wonderful and very talented pianist. And we were hanging out in the mid-70s. We were playing some jobs together, and it was through his introduction to his father that I became a part of Chapito's band, usually when the second trumpet player that he usually used was sick or couldn't make it, had a conflict. So it was kind of, you know, as I was becoming familiar with gigging around town. So I was quite young, you know, 17 years old.
What was it like at that age being part of this massive thing here in the Phoenix area?
Well, it was really kind of a trial by fire because I was used to playing in college stage bands and high school groups. And with Chapito, these were real gigs. This was, you know, somebody's wedding, or we would play at some of these big Mexican dance halls. It was quite an introduction to the world of performing, the world of entertaining people, keeping them on the dance floor. So it was a real eye-opener.
For those of us who never got to go to one of his shows, can you describe what they were like?
Well, first of all, he was very committed to pleasing the audience, pleasing the dancers, keeping people on the dance floor. That's why club owners loved him so much and why the people, especially the community, the Mexican-American community, if someone wanted to hear a song two or three times over, we would play it. And there was no second-guessing that. That was just something to keep everybody entertained because a lot of these dances, a lot of these gatherings were community networking events. And so he was quite aware of his role within the community, within the Chicano community, the Mexican-American community. And so that was also something that was, you know, very apparent as we were working and entertaining these people.
What would you describe his role as, both in his community and in the greater Valley community?
Well, he hired the best players. I mean, I was, at that time, I was kind of getting my feet wet, but it was a very wonderful experience to be surrounded by so many great musicians. Just the idea of how you work a job, how you keep the people happy, how you keep the people satisfied, how to structure your solo, how to blend with the other people, how to just be, you know, musical about what you're doing in addition to entertaining the people.
What do you think his legacy is on both the style of music that he played and on sort of music in general here in town?
Well, I think it's important to remember that he comes from what we call the Mexican-American generation, those veterans from World War II who came back from service, and he was a World War II veteran. And, you know, after serving in the Army, after being in uniform, lots of Mexican-American veterans, you know, they had proved themselves. And when they came back to places like Phoenix and Tucson and throughout the Southwest, you know, they had an agency, if you will, to meet and gather. And so he was very important in the formation of Post 41, which is the Veterans of Foreign Wars post here in downtown Phoenix, because prior to that, there was not a place for Mexican-Americans to meet on that type of level. So he was one of the people that other community leaders looked to keep that community together and to keep that spirit of community, of networking, of starting off in this new situation, this new kind of American role that had been proven through their service to the country.
Devin Leal Bridgewater is a trumpet and violin player. He was remembering his friend, bandleader Rafael Chapito Chavarria, who passed away December 26th at the age of 100. It's time to head to another of the Valley's hot corners, spots with a lot going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
Hi, I'm Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
And where are we today?
We are on the corner of Scottsdale Road and Lincoln.
It's a busy intersection, both in terms of traffic and reasons to get out of the car.
You could probably eat for 2 weeks and eat at a different place at this corner we've picked out.
So what to you makes this a hot corner?
Well, the new places, obviously. We're sitting at a Scramble right now, which is the second outpost for the Sunny Slope restaurant. It's a breakfast place and lunch. And we've got a couple other new places. There's some luxury apartments behind us. So this is just a really hot new area with these three restaurants right here in a row.
So we are on the northwest corner of Scottsdale Road in Lincoln in a center called Marketplace at Lincoln and Scottsdale. I'm reading it on the sign over there.
Correct.
And just in this one little center, there's a few relatively new places.
There's three brand new restaurants that have opened up in the last year. The one that we're sitting at right now is Scramble. And then the next one that opened was Sumo Maya. That opened in June of 2014. And that is from the people that have Local Bistro and Central Bistro, which are kind of Mediterranean Italian places, and this one's totally different. It's a Latin and Asian fusion restaurant.
And if you like Italian, there's a place just across from where we're sitting that is an Italian restaurant.
That is true. It's called Vivo, which means life in Italian, and it is from the veteran restaurateur Tommaso Maggiore. Of Tommaso's fame, yeah. His Camelback restaurant is, 38 years old or something? This is more of a modern take of an Italian cafe, I believe.
And then if you just cross Lincoln to the south of here is where the Borgata used to be, but there's some restaurants still in there.
Sam Fox's Blanco's Tequila and Tacos is still there, and there's a new one, Paul Martin's, which is from the P.F. Chang founder, Paul Fleming, and this is the second location of that, actually. The first one was in Napa, but it's kind of American, it's upscale.
And if that's not enough, just a short walk south of here is Hilton Village. There's Houston's, which has been there for a long time, and some other restaurants in there as well?
Yeah, there's some new restaurants there, too, and besides Houston's, there's another old restaurant that's there that's really fabulous. It's old-school Italian called Veneto Trattoria, and I highly recommend that. If you want that really old-school feeling of Italian, that's a great place to go to. But some new restaurants have opened there too. Three: Binks Scottsdale, which is from Kevin Binkley and Amy Binkley, major delicious farm-to-table type food there. Anyway, so that's their restaurant there. Also, Slanted Rice, which is a modern Vietnamese cafe from the Tran family that also own rice paper on 7th Street. And then there's kind of like a gastro pub called Tap House Kitchen. Lots of great craft beer on draft, lots of cocktails, and lots of, I would say, upscale comfort food.
So who do you think is coming to all of these restaurants? There's a lot of restaurants in a very short concentration of road here. And it's, as you can hear, a busy road.
Busy
it's Scottsdale Road.
It's
one of the major thoroughfares in this part of town.
It is.
So who do you think is coming to all these restaurants?
People who have money. Do you know where we are? We are
PV is right over there, right?
We are right next to Paradise Valley. There's a lot of apartments here. There's a lot of houses behind this little intersection here, too. So I think a lot of people can walk to these if they want. I would if I lived right here.
This is also the part of Scottsdale that has a decent number of resorts, just a little bit further south on Scottsdale Road. Are these the kinds of restaurants that folks staying in resorts, maybe coming here during winter, would come to see?
Yes, and especially, I would say, the Hilton Village, because it is closer to some of those resorts you're talking about, and I think all of those are within walking distance of that, and then if they can come a little further.
You mentioned walking distance, and I can imagine people taking their lives into their hands trying to walk along Scottsdale Road.
People whiz by, don't
seriously,
they?
I mean, some of the hot corners we've been to have really been walkable areas. Mm-hmm. You know, where restaurants sort of depend on folks sort of walking up and down the sidewalk,
right,
being able to cross the street.
Right.
I'm getting the sense that maybe isn't so much the case here.
Well, I think you have a mix, but you are correct. I'm not sure that you want to mess with that. It's not a pleasant to walk down the street when these cars are whizzing by at 45 miles an hour.
Or more.
They're not supposed to, though. But, yeah, it can be. But, you know, anyone that lives back here, where, you know, behind us a little bit to the west, like those brand new apartments there, that I'm sure they're walking over here. I would. I mean, how far would they drive? 200 yards?
It'd probably take longer to start their car and to get here than it would just to hop the fence or walk through a gate.
It would. This is a great little area, though, I love. And I'm so happy to see all these independent restaurants here. And new restaurants are always fun. You know, who doesn't want to go out and eat at a restaurant? I do.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met at the corner of Scottsdale Road and Lincoln in Scottsdale.
Weather around the valley, especially during the recent years of drought, tends to be predictable. Then a winter storm pushes through, temperatures plummet, and there are reports of snow only a few miles outside of Phoenix. The practicalities and science of weather will be a big part of the American Meteorological Society's annual meeting, which opens over the weekend at the Phoenix Convention Center. Ken Waters is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service's Phoenix office. He says one of the topics up for discussion is how technology has changed forecasting and increased its accuracy.
The computers can go out anywhere from 7 days, maybe even out to 2 weeks in advance. With the improvement in computers, computer speed and memory, cheaper memory, and smarter software, if you will. So no question about it, we've made a lot of improvements. We still can't get it right all the time. That's kind of the real challenge of science. We can't let the computers determine everything. We still have to put that human influence in there of a meteorologist to try to interpret everything.
Ken, when you get a lot of people together who are professionals who've been in the business short time, long time, but know a lot about, obviously, meteorology, are there interesting arguments that come up? Do you get any good debates?
Absolutely. I think each year, one of the best ways to push the science forward is to share your results. And with sharing, other people get other ideas.
Going forward, I mean, is there a promise to be seen in that? Not just the longer forecast models, but to know that whether a microburst might land here or whether if you're in a certain area, because that's one of the things I think people get really concerned about during the monsoon is 3 miles away, I heard that there was almost like a tornado, and here there's nothing.
One of the big new emphasis that we're dealing with here in this field is dealing with social implications. Basically, how does the public take our forecast? Do they take it seriously? We're all about saving lives and property. We continue to hear instances in the news of situations where maybe a major weather event was coming, and a number of people just maybe they got the message, but they didn't think it was relevant or was really going to affect them. i.e., oh, we've been through hurricanes before, and we've survived them, so we can survive another one, that sort of thing. There's been a lot of new emphasis on this whole thing about how the public takes and accepts our forecast and how the, what the reaction is going to be. Another great example is Atlanta, the big snow event that happened last year. It's a little bit of a difference in the forecast can make a huge, huge impact on the public. And that basically paralyzed the entire metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing more extreme events, extreme weather events in the U.S.? Are we seeing a pattern of that? Well, you know, we think about Superstorm Sandy, you mentioned Atlanta.
That's a tough one to answer. I know that some scientists have come out and said that because of, you know, trying to link climate change, perhaps, that we're getting more and more extreme events. In some circumstances, that certainly would be possible. I think with things like the rising sea level, things like landfalling storms, like Sandy, does this mean we're going to have more hurricanes? Does this mean we're going to have more tornadoes? And interestingly enough, this year was one of the lowest number of tornadoes. So there's arguments going both ways.
Ken Waters at the National Weather Service's Phoenix office. The American Meteorological Society's annual meeting kicks off this weekend with WeatherFest, which is open to the public. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on 91.5, a mix of regional, national, and international stories on KJZZ.
He's the only Arizona politician who served in all three branches of government. Many called him Mac, but there was a lot more behind that simple nickname. Historians say he was one of the most important figures in Arizona's post-World War II history. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us his story.
Senator Ernest McFarland was a man of many offices. Many remember him as the senator and governor of Arizona. Did you know he's also the founder of several programs, including the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, better known as the GI Bill?
He was a very multifaceted, talented guy who you wouldn't think upon meeting him that he was this impressive a person.
Jack August Jr. is a historian of the American West. He says McFarland's list of accomplishments is long.
Private attorney, deputy county attorney, this is down in Pinal County. Then U.S. Senator for two terms, governor for two terms. He becomes an associate justice of the Arizona State Supreme Court, and then he becomes chief justice of the Arizona Supreme Court.
Oklahoma native McFarland came to Arizona after serving in World War I. Military doctors suggested he move to a dry climate after he overcame a serious bronchial infection. He lived here for a while, working in a bank, and made enough money to attend Stanford University Law School. By 1940, he was elected to the Senate. August says McFarland had a particular interest in veterans and their service from the moment the U.S. entered World War II.
He, I think, initiated somewhere around 40 bills helping the veterans. It was in a broader context of what to do with these service people when they came back to the United States. Would put them to work with dams, kind of an extension of the New Deal and some of the development of our infrastructure in the American West.
August says McFarland was an eloquent writer and wrote the GI Bill himself. The legislation provided financial assistance to veterans. It included school tuition, low-interest rate small business loans, and low-cost home loans.
It's helped over 50 million people in this country, and it really helped facilitate the growth of our middle class in the post-World War II period. And I would say it's probably the most important piece of domestic social legislation in the post-World War II era.
McFarland's accomplishments don't stop there. He is the only sitting Arizona governor who helped argue and win a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Arizona versus California case over water rights was also the longest Supreme Court case in American history. McFarland is the reason Arizona has state parks. He purchased the old Pinal County Courthouse in Florence and donated it to the state to create the Arizona State Park System. August says McFarland was also a visionary. When television was making its way into the public, he decided to invest in the business. In the early 1950s, the Federal Communications Commission granted McFarland a television license, which created KTVK. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we ought to know, let us know about them. Send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
You probably just finished reading all of the 2014 year-end lists of the best movies, books, and music of the year. But if you're anything like us, you're already chomping at the bit in anticipation for what's to come in 2015. And thankfully, there's lots of good local music to look forward to.
Burnt night here in this city.
I talked with Lenore Lanova, one of the co-founders of the local music blog Yab Yum, about what local releases she's most excited about in the new year.
Phoenix and the surrounding area really has a very eclectic music scene. Any sort of genre you might be interested in, I can almost guarantee you'll find a band here that you like. But some of the styles that are more specific to the area, I think we do have a very strong sort of weird folk, weird punk movement with the younger kids. That's really gained a lot in popularity in the past few years. Some of those bands like Playboy Man Baby, Leonardo da Capricorn, they really have developed sort of a following for that sort of Phoenix-style strangeness.
What have you heard so far that maybe the average person hasn't heard that they will hear in 2015? What has you excited or what has you surprised?
Well, 2014 was such a wonderful year. It's going to be hard to top, but from some of the early tracks we've been listening to, I can definitely say 2015 is going to be a contender for one of the best years in music here. The band Decker out of Sedona, they are working on a new album, Patsy, that'll be coming out in January that lots of folks are very excited about.
Fool me once, said shame on you. Got a thing to say or two. Been digging in the dirt for days. Have made a humble home for bones to lay. So if you got something to say, why don't you take it to the grave?
Decker is fronted by Brandon Decker, and they've been going through some lineup changes this year. So we're excited to see the new lineup in 2015.
Is that changing their sound as they change their lineup?
They have kind of a fuller, richer sound now. Some of the earlier Decker albums has a bit more of a stripped-down Americana. This one, you definitely hear more of the fullness of gospel music in it. It's definitely going to be a wonderful album. We've had a sneak listen, so we can't wait.
Clean up the wounds, bandage what bleeds, rambling, gambling, scramble if you please. They see the road to hell is paved with plenty of these, but then they get on their knees for pray to a priest. So if you got something to say, I guess someone is always listening.
What's the next track we should try?
So the JJCMV track is The Rowdiest I Brought. So that's JJCNV. They kind of have a different sound from other punk bands in the area, which is one of the things I really like about them. A lot of times when you're hearing punk bands, you're hearing a rehashing of earlier sounds, music that was popular in the 70s or the 80s, or God forbid, punk pop of the 90s. But with JJCNV, you're really getting something different, something modern, but still incorporating that harder punk sound. There's a lot of gurs and guitars and distortion, and it's wonderful. And we should be expecting that album probably late January, early February.
Now, is that the only track you've heard so far?
I've actually heard a couple of tracks.
Can you give us an idea? I mean, is that basically what people are going to hear? Is that the sort of the driving beat, or do they sort of change it up from?
They definitely don't have what I would consider like a shoebox sound where everything sounds exactly the same. They definitely vary throughout their tracks, which is really nice when you're listening to albums all day. The next track is from a band called Fairy Bones, and they've been working on an album for a while. They released a couple of singles this past year in prelude to an album that's coming out in 2015. So we've had a lot of time to spend with these songs, and now the anticipation's just there. Like, we want the rest of them. We want them now. Chelsea Louise, who's the front woman for Fairy Bones, just has this incredible musical theater voice. And when she applies it to the rock and roll that her band makes, you really get something special. Cary Bones Crew is known for mixing things up. They definitely combine different genres to make their own sounds, and really one of those bands that you want to see perform live, because until you see Chelsea belting it out on top of her, on top of the speakers, you really haven't lived.
You put quite a mix together for us, really, from all moods of the day or night. It's great.
Yeah, we're an eclectic bunch. We try and branch out into all things.
So what's our next track?
This song is from a band called Owl and Penny. A musician by the name of Brian Osterman fronts that band. He has a very peaceful, mellow, almost nature-driven sound. You'll definitely hear a lot of imagery in his music, and just a beautiful songwriter. He's going to be releasing a new EP called Elder this year, and we brought the track Wild Woods from that.
That had a very thick sound, thicker than the other tracks you've heard.
Right. I think in the layering of sounds, he definitely creates those visual landscapes that you sort of follow in your mind when you're listening. And just the richness of those layers, it almost sounds like he's using felled trees and sticks to beat out a drum. It's going to be a wonderful release, I'm sure.
Lenore Lenova is one of the co-founders of the local music blog Yab Yum. To hear some of the music we're looking forward to in 2015, including some extras that you haven't heard yet, visit kjzz.org.
And if you're looking for something to do this weekend, you can watch the Coyotes take on the Columbus Blue Jackets at Gila River Arena. That's tomorrow night at 6 in Glendale.
If you're looking for a laugh to start off the new year, you can listen to the show, of course, but then check out Murder for Two at the Herberger Theater Center in Phoenix. The last show tonight is at 7:30.
This weekend is your last chance to catch the Zappe Italian Family Circus at the Chandler Center for the Arts.
That's interesting, because I ate Italian this week and had zuppa, which actually is soup. Mark.
And you ate with your family, right?
And with my hands.
Was it a circus?
No, Bill Keane, thank you.
You can also catch the Mesa Arts and Crafts Festival first Saturday of the month. That's in downtown Mesa tomorrow, starting at 10.
Today's show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo, Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, Aubrey Abril of the digital team, the managing editor, Al Macias, the executive producer, the impeccable one, John Hoba.
We always like to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. If you have good stuff for us to do this weekend, you can tell us that too. The show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.